Welcome back, everybody, to today's Brexit podcast. It's the Tuesday show, and normally we're doing a news roundup of what's been happening in the last week. But there's one particularly high-profile point that we want to pick up on this time, and it's the EU's negotiation plan, which came out on Saturday, I think. And I have got my co-host, Jennifer Hahn, to talk me through the key points of this. So we're going to have a discussion. Jen, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Yeah, so the 27 EU leaders have put forward the final version of their negotiation guidelines. They've already put forward like a draft of this back in March, but this is the new and improved version. And basically, one of the main things is something that the EU has been quite strict on this far is saying that there will be no trade negotiations whatsoever until 2 years from now when the UK has properly exited the EU. This is now slightly changed in the revised version. And the document says that the European Council will monitor progress closely and determine when sufficient progress has been achieved to allow negotiations to proceed. So obviously sufficient progress is still an incredibly vague term. So the ball is technically still in the EU's court, so they can decide when the UK has sort of done enough, when enough has been decided for us to move into trade negotiations. But I suppose it might be a bit of an olive branch to say that we're not completely opposed to getting things started off early with trade negotiations.
Yeah, just taking it back one step, the reason for sitting down and the 27 states coming together and actually putting out something is to try and put a roadmap in place and underline their position. And their position is very much a hardball one, isn't it, to protect the European Union?
In general, it definitely is, yeah. In the little changes that have been made this far, you can definitely tell that at some points it's individual member states trying to get some more clarity out of the UK and being a bit more hardline. But I think maybe in this case it's a little bit of a step towards, so a bit of a trying to have a push and pull situation going on. Because obviously if you just pull, you're not going to get anywhere.
No, but then they need to make it very clear that they don't want other states to follow Britain's lead and leave the European Union.
Yes, definitely. And they've also, so obviously this was set out in the first draft as well, but in case people aren't aware of what's in there, so they've also set out that there should be absolutely no separate negotiations between individual member states and the UK. So it says that all negotiations under Article 50 must be conducted in transparency and as a single package to sort of prevent the UK from exploiting any kind of friction that's already there between member states to then get some kind of gain out of it. So that's already quite like a hardball situation, because as we know, May was trying to talk to different individual leaders to already try and do some negotiation there, but that's quite a hard line against that.
So they want it to be legally binding, don't they? But it's entirely unenforceable.
What do you mean?
Well, you can't stop Theresa May going for dinner with whichever president or head of state that she wants to and having informal discussions.
Yes, I mean, I think that's always going to take place. But I think this is supposed to be sort of the EU member states showing a united front against the UK trying to get any kind of competitive advantage over the rest of the member states, especially in the single market, so that the UK doesn't get any better of a deal out of it than it has being in there, because otherwise that would just get other member states to want to leave the union as well. So I just think,
of course, but it's classic. Did you do game theory at school? This is reminds me of when I was in GCSEs doing classic game theory, because it's like the EU feels it's stronger together to drive that best deal. But when you look at those individual states, what needs to be top of their interest? If they're doing a hell of a lot of trade with the Great Britain, maybe, I'm sure a lot of the citizens will think that's, and companies will think that's a lot more important than being part of this compact 27 statewide European Union.
I mean, is the UK that much of a big trade partner, though?
Well, I think that will be the point that Theresa May will be trying to constantly impress, yeah, when she has these discussions with people.
Mm. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the fact that, we've talked about this before as well, the two of us, on my weekly news roundup, that there have been some suggestions that different sectors might be able to stay in the single market. So there was talk of like finance or the car industry. And then as we discussed, Amber had suggestion of like the hospitality and like barista, bartender type of industry. But these guidelines specifically say that preserving the integrity of the single market excludes participation based on a sector by sector approach. So that's sort of definitely not happening. I mean, this might change during negotiations if the UK has something to offer in exchange. But I think they're quite like set on this, that there is not going to be like a half in, half out type of situation.
Jean-Claude Juncker had lunch with Theresa May, I believe, before the EU's negotiation plan was revealed, and he brought with him a 2,255-page document which outlines EU's trade agreement with Canada. I think that might be slightly passive-aggressive behaviour, just telling her how hard it's all going to be.
I mean, I suppose at this point it's all sort of tactics, isn't it, when it comes to negotiations? It's all like, to be honest, I think politics is never going to be like, diplomatic politics is never going to be open aggression. It's always going to be like little digs and side like hints to unsettle the other person, isn't it? I think that's just what we're going to see over the next 2 years, isn't it?
Probably right. May of course dismiss that by saying the situation between UK and the European Union is entirely different to the one with Canada, because of course we are already part of it.
So just to stay on finance actually for a bit, the EU has also specifically added a little clause in there, a little phrase, and apparently this is under the pressure of France to say that the UK should respect the regulatory and supervisory regime and standards of the European Union, meaning that they're trying to prevent the UK from sort of radically deregulating, especially the financial industry, to get some kind of competitive advantage over the rest of the country. So France apparently has been quite adamant that the UK should still stay under these rules, which of course is going to be hard to make that point when the whole point of the UK leaving is that they will be outside of the regulatory framework of the EU. So that should be quite an interesting one to watch.
Yeah, and that deals specifically with the financial sector. I guess that could come across to any sector though, couldn't it?
Yes, I think it could. I think this specifically is referring to that, but I think it applies in general as well, because it could be sort of product standards, for example, if there was a way to cheaply manufacture something, but it wouldn't be allowed under EU guidelines, and then UK firms were suddenly allowed to do it and then could produce more for less money, then obviously that would give a competitive advantage as well.
And just looking with finance for a second, if we do leave, there is issues resulting from the multi-annual financial framework. So there's going to be some cost, some hard cost to the UK in leaving. The European Union do want a single financial settlement. Relates to the European Investment Bank, Development Fund and the Central Bank. So basically they demand that we do pay our dues before we step out.
Yeah, basically that's the like simplified version of saying it. Any existing like monetary commitments that the UK has, they are adamant that they should continue to pay them. So to pay into the current 7-year EU budget framework, which ends not until 2020, even though the exit is in March 2019. So I think Council President Donald Tusk has said that the UK will be expected to continue paying and will still be governed by EU law under the European Court of Justice during any transitional deals. So from withdrawal in 2019 until the date that any new agreement begins on trade. So he's saying that's for a maximum of 3 years. So technically we could still be under EU regulations and be paying into the fund for a maximum of like 5 years, I suppose, if we're leaving for 2 and then another 3 years after that.
So that would take us up to potentially the next general election in this country?
It might do, depending on how fast things get settled, really, which at this point is, I think, pretty impossible to tell.
So what else have you found from the report, Jen?
So on the rights of EU citizens, of course, that had to be touched on. So the EU really wants there to be distinctly set out legal guarantees to EU citizens who've lived in the UK for 5 continuous years or more, not just a verbal agreement or something like that. And it's also specifically saying that citizens should be able to exercise their rights through smooth and simple administrative procedures. And I think this is referring to all of the issues that people have reported having with applying for indefinite leave to remain. There have been so many stories about the massive bureaucratic hurdles that are being put in people's way, asking them provide documentation that's basically impossible for them to have. Like, I think there was a story of a mother who wanted to prove that her child had been living here, but obviously it's not like the child had been paying taxes or anything, so she literally didn't have any way to provide the documentation that they asked for. And then there's also, I've heard that people need to keep track and then be able to show receipts for every time they've left the country since they've lived here, which just seems completely impossible that you could expect that from anyone. So the draft also, this final version of the negotiation guidelines also included the fact that the immigration policy should be non-discriminatory. So I'm presuming this is to say that England can't just pick certain nationalities and professions to keep and the rest to check out. So it was quite hard line, obviously, on the rights of EU citizens, as it should be.
This is one that I sense that perhaps might get agreed sooner rather than later.
I would hope so. Yeah. I think
it seems that if, in terms of kicking off with some, I guess, some softer negotiations, it would probably be one that that Theresa May would probably commit to. I haven't seen whether the EU said anything about guaranteeing the rights of British citizens in Europe. Don't know if that was even mentioned in the report. I didn't see it.
I didn't see it. No.
No.
I'm assuming it would be as a reciprocal situation. Whatever the UK offers, the EU will offer back, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it would have been useful, and if I missed it, then apologies to the listeners, but it would be useful probably to have mentioned that at the time.
Yeah.
I just want to talk please.
I wanted to say that in regards to Northern Ireland, Brexit Secretary David Davis has already recognised that if reunification vote were to happen in Ireland, and Northern Ireland were to vote to be part of Ireland itself again, then that would automatically make all Northern Irish citizens EU citizens, and the EU has also set this out in their guidelines. So I think that's just in case people weren't sure what the EU's stance was on that, that's been decided as well. Sorry, what did you want to say?
Yeah, I guess that would hold for Scotland then as well in that case. I mean, you would think it would be a very similar thing if Scotland had independence, and
I don't know if that's true. Because this is already specifically set out in the Good Friday Agreement, the fact that Northern Ireland would then become a part of Ireland and a part of the EU.
The Republic. So,
Yeah. So I don't know if the same applies for Scotland, really.
I'll have to get Conor Devine to get back on and talk about that one.
Yeah. I mean, I think it might be different because Ireland obviously is still going to be a part of the EU when we exit, so the Northern Ireland would then just become part of an EU country rather than Scotland if it left the UK. It would just be a country in and of itself with no belongings. So I don't think it would be the same.
No, although there'd be a myriad of social, economic, emotional, historical reasons to fight through as well before all of that happened. I think that would just be the latest in it.
Yeah.
A long twist of the last couple of years of crazy things happening in the world. I just wanted to talk about the people that are actually going to be doing the negotiations a little bit. So we've got, as well as Theresa May and Angela Merkel, we've got Michael Barnier. So he's the Master of French and UK Diplomacy. He's the chief negotiator for the EU. So his counterpart on the UK side would be Brexit Secretary David Davis. And then we've got Sabine Weyand. Jean-Claude de Juncker is quite fond of her, said she's one of the Commission's biggest and brightest. And so she's the deputy chief negotiator, studied at Cambridge University. I think all of these names are going to start coming more and more to the fore. And we've got Donald Tusk, who's probably a little bit more familiar to everyone. He warned that the UK leaving could end in the destruction of not only the UK, but also the Western political civilization in its entirety. So he's not...
So quite upbeat things, yeah.
Yeah, he's a former Polish Prime Minister and President of the European Council. And Didier Souz, is that how we pronounce it? S-W-E-U-W-S. And he heads the Council's task force for the Brexit negotiations. So that's on the European side. On the UK side, David Davis, who's
Brexit Secretary,
as we know. Oliver Robbins, who's a civil servant in David Davis's department. So he's going to be playing a key role. He was formerly a member of Gordon Brown's Treasury, helped coordinate public spending policy. And Tim Barrow. So he took over from Sir Ivan Rogers, didn't he? Remember when he Sir Ivan Rogers?
Yeah, I remember.
An episode on that. You flip back through. So he's career diplomat. And finally, the other one is Sarah Healy, who's Director General of David Davis's department. So those are the chief figures. We still want to get somebody on to talk about the general overview of negotiating tactics. I think it would be quite an interesting episode.
Yeah, that definitely would be really interesting. And to run us through who these people are in a bit more detail, it would be nice to get an expert on to give us a bit more insight. I think those were all the major points that I wanted to draw out. But finally, I just wanted to say that I found the Sun's coverage of this quite ironic, because it basically complained that the tone of the guidelines was divisive and feeding an us and them mentality, which I think is very rich coming from the Sun. And it was also saying that Donald Tusk referred to the united remaining members and calling the UK a third country, so trying to be divisive in that sense. And I think this is not such an odd thing for the Sun to complain about, considering that's exactly what they and the Brexiteers called for this entire time. They were like, oh, we want to leave, we want to be independent, and now it's like, oh, what do you mean you're talking about you as a united front and us as an independent person? That's not right, that's divisive. But yeah, sorry, I just thought I'd draw attention to that.
I hear the irony with that one. I think with Tusk in saying that, perhaps he could have chosen his language a little bit better, though. I mean, to call the United Kingdom a third country and the rest, the United Members of Europe, maybe just referring to us as, you know, United Kingdom or Great Britain might have been a little bit more of a tactful way of doing it.
I mean, that is true, though. Like, I think Theresa May was complaining about this as well, that she had this feeling that the rest of the countries were ganging up on the UK. And I actually saw quite a funny tweet about this. I couldn't remember for the life of me who it was by, but it was basically saying something along the lines of, what do you mean they're like a united sort of union of countries, so that's why they're ganging up together? That would make sense, seeing as they're the EU, a union of countries in Europe.
Yeah,
so
I understand that. I think where the whole thing needs to work better is in the terms of language, and it is a slightly passive aggressive language from Donald Tusk.
Don't you think that Theresa May has been passive aggressive as well, though? I feel like that's like the way this entire discussion and the preliminary negotiations have been taking part, just with all of the passive aggression.
Or solid and strong leadership, isn't that the
Of course, yes, solid and strong leadership always.
Yes, from my personal point of view, I think it would be better to if everyone was a little softer and just put their arms around each other and gave each other a big hug a little bit more, we might get on. There's the world a lot better that way.
Well, on that note, I think that's quite a happy note to end that, really. Calling for love and happiness. That's quite nice. Unless you have anything else you want to say today.
No, and we can probably times that by 10 when we get Tommy Holgate back on the show. He was one of our very first guests, and he's standing for the Peace Party in the upcoming general election. So we might get him back on to spread a little bit joy and happiness as we move forward.
That sounds good. For the start of summer, what else do we need but a bit of happiness?
Thanks for joining us, Jen.
Thanks, Tim.
And thanks for all the listeners as well. You've been listening to the Brexit Podcast. It's a production by Warren Pole, Jennifer Hahn and Tim Hemming. See, Warren got props then for the first time. And the theme music is by Kevin MacLeod. Oh, you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and all the social media gubbins.
And at brexitpodcast.com.